And thank you very much, all the members of the committee, for being here so promptly, especially on Friday morning. And I hope that at the very least we're able to stay until 12:15 to address what could only be regarded as an important issue that's come to the committee. We'd like to also welcome the Minister of Trade and Industry, Dr. Rob Davies, thank you very much, the DG, Mr. Lionel October, and the DDG, the Chief Operating Officer, is that it? Ms. Jody Potts, right. And also, although I don't see him just in my, on my radar screen, the DDG for International Trade and Economic Development, Mr. Xavier Karim. I just can't find you. Are you on the radar screen?
No, he's not here.
Not yet. Right. Okay. So we do want to speed up on things as the request has come from a couple of quarters. And it may be pertinent at this stage to just adopt the agenda as it is right now, and that is the briefing by the Minister in respect to the budget, SONA, etc., consideration of the minutes just to ensure we've got that quorum, a mini tea break. Really, it's hardly a tea break. It'll be rolling. You'll roll out and roll back. And then the final item will be the engagement with perhaps what we have all been wanting to seek clarification on, the National Lotteries Board. At this stage, can we please get someone to propose adoption of the agenda? Honourable James?
I'm not sure, Madam Chair, what happened, but the Minister and his team were here since Office 8, so... I'm not sure what the reason was, but I think they owed an apology for whatever caused it.
Well, I think I must just do seek an official clarification on that, but knowing the Minister as I do, the one thing is that he's always too early rather than not even just over the hour of being late. But, of course, I'm sure there's a far more serious official explanation than that track record. Because I do know he is here before any of us. I do like to come in myself a couple of minutes later so as to not have to look for members, you know, the erstwhile ones who are held up in traffic or have all these tire bursts. Did I mislead your parliamentary liaison officer in any way? Well, thank you as usual for being here so early. And, well, there we are. I think Mr. James, Honourable James, that's been clarified, has it not? Can we seek, yes, Honourable Khadebe?
Chair, I propose the adoption of the agenda.
May we have a seconder? Thank you. We can now proceed to the briefing. Well, that looks like we're even on time. Thank you, Minister.
Small slides, but I'm not going to sort of directly speak to them. They're rather, I think, more as background. We were asked to speak on the relevance of the SONA to the work of the DTI, and I think I'm also going to make a few comments about some of the highlights in the budget which relate to the work of the DTI. I think that this, I want to start off by saying that I think that is the message that came out of both of those speeches about the changes in the nature of the world economy and the challenges that we face right in the immediate future are pertinent. We have been seeing a major structural shift in the world economy, with emerging economies becoming the driving forces of dynamism, growth, and development. And this is, for example, highlighted by the fact that by 2050, BRICS countries are expected to account for 47% of world GDP. And in the next few years, they may account for something like 61% of global growth. So I think that this is the sort of picture that's taking place. The other feature of this is that the African continent is very much part of the of that growth story. In fact, after Asia, Africa is the next growth prospect, with the IMF predicting that African growth this year will average 5.5%. So I think that from the medium-term point of view, South Africa as a member of the BRICS, as part of the African continent, is very well placed to realize the benefits of those structural shifts. We are occupying, I think, a rather strategic position in that, and if we play our cards right and make a number of decisions in the medium and longer term appropriately, I think that we are well placed. But of course what we are facing now is immediately a threat of contagion from the other side of that story, which is the serious challenges in the European Union. We know that the European Union is going through a recession. Many parts of the European Union will be experiencing recession. A number of key economies in Europe have had negative growth in the last quarter of last year, and I think many of them look like they will have negative growth in the first quarter of this year. And it's not restricted just to Greece, which is experiencing very, very serious recession, but it's more widespread than that. So I think that is the factor that's going to affect us. And I think that factor means that there will be, since Europe is still our major trading partner as a bloc, although China is our individual largest trading partner, that's going to mean that there's going to be some impact outside of Europe itself from the effects of that. The second-order effects of the European crisis are going to be felt by not only ourselves, but I mean including ourselves, but many other economies as well. So I think that's the background in which a lot of these things that we need to do are going to be taking place. And I'm going to come to, particularly in a second, the Manufacturing Competitiveness Enhancement Program, because it is entirely trying to address that particular challenge. The State of the Nation address focused on, as I think everybody knows, has been the debate. I wasn't here for the debate, but the debate is focused on the Infrastructure Investment Program, and I think in particular the work of the Presidential Infrastructure Coordination Commission. And the President announced a number of key highlights of that. There were some more details given in the budget, and I think there will be further details emerging in due course. But let me just say that I think that what we have here before us is a major advance in infrastructure planning in this country, that we have had infrastructure programs taking place. We have seen infrastructure as basically a major driver of the economy. We have seen infrastructure as addressing a number of key shortcomings that need to be overcome in order to make the economy more competitive. And we've also, in our particular neck of the woods, seen infrastructure as a major driver of industrialization if we then respond with other policies. So I think we've seen the infrastructure program as very important. And what we've now done, I think, is to take on board very seriously a number of the lessons of the World Cup. We've tried to identify what's worked well, what's worked badly, how have we chosen some particular projects which have emerged, and some of them have been very, very ad hoc, and how have we not been able to choose some of the ones which are actually perhaps of more strategic advantage and benefit to the economy. And I think you'll see when the details start emerging from the PICC that there's been a very major step forward, I believe, in terms of planning, identification of opportunities, sequencing, and then also things like addressing some of the details of how these things are going to be financed, and also a strategy to raise finance for these infrastructure programs. So I think that's the background. Now, the DTI has participated in the PICC through Deputy Minister Tabeti and our officials, but we really come in, I think, in terms of the infrastructure program drives our economy, drives economic development, is our main counter-cyclical response. But then what do we do in terms of getting manufacturing off that that infrastructure program? And I think that we have, over a number of years, identified that in our infrastructure programs in general, we've had too high what we call import leakage, that we have been importing things that we don't need to import. We have not been getting the manufacturing benefits sufficiently off the infrastructure investment programs. And I think you'll see that over the years of the IPAP 2, we've been progressively addressing the question of reform of procurement. We've had far too much ad hoc procurement where there's a project undergoing underway at some particular moment. It needs some particular item. You look around, you say it's not available on the South African market, you import it. Then 5 years later, you in another phase of the same project and you do the same thing. We've had ad hoc procurement instead of strategic procurement, and instead of what the term goes, fleet procurement. Fleet procurement basically means that you identify all the different phases of a program, and you then package it into a single procurement process. And if you say in phase one, let's say for example, the products are not available in South Africa to a very large extent, and we have to accept that we're going to import 75% of them, by phase two, the same people will be expected to produce more in South Africa than they did in the first phase, and so on. So that's the top of the pyramid. The second thing that we did, and we started to do it at the end of last year, was that the procurement regulations have changed, and that there is the possibility in terms of the new public, the Triple PFA regulations, for the DTI to designate, according to various technical criteria, percentages and things of that sort, we are able to designate that these should be purchased by all organs of state from South African suppliers. And we started that process on December the 7th, and the designations were a combination of the phases of the infrastructure investment program that we were in at that time. And so we picked, for example, the railway investments. Prasa and Transnet are both making investments, and we made a designation around railway equipment. The Medupi and Kosili power stations, the construction of those, the contracts have already been awarded, but arising from that is investments in electricity transmission lines. So we identified those, and we identified a number of other regular purchases, uniforms and workwear in government departments, and we've designated those as a requirement of local purchasing from local production according to percentages and so on. Now that we started, and we're indicating that that was the first phase of the localization. It's not the end of the process. So as the infrastructure program rolls out, and having a more coherent infrastructure program makes a great advantage, a great benefit to us in this work, we're able to identify which bits of the infrastructure program are coming on track when, and then how we can then work towards more localization. We're also, I think you've heard a presentation in this committee, we're reviewing the NIPP, the industrial participation, and there's a number of things around that. There's been some lack of clarity as to whether the NIPP applies across all spheres of government, and we want to clarify that it does, and that would mean that everybody who buys more than $10 million at all levels of government would have to negotiate some offset arrangement with a supplier. And in particular, I think what we want to prioritize is what we call direct NIPs, so that we have more of, you are going to buy buses, then let's make the buses also, buses, by the way, were also designated, but let's make the bus manufacturers who may be foreign investors come and invest and manufacture in our country and make buses rather than, invest in filmmaking or something completely peripheral to their main work. That's what we're trying to do. So I think that piece of work has been ongoing and is very much linked to the infrastructure program. Let me say we will be presenting, as we always do, a rolling three-year IPAP, which will come into effect on the 1st of April. I've seen the first draft. There's a second draft now, which will build on the work which we've done. It will introduce a few new elements. I don't want to talk about those in any great detail. But we will be introducing our rolling IPAP on the 1st of April, as we've done before. It will be referring to the IPAP for the current financial year and then the outer two. It will be the rolling IPAP that we intend to introduce, as we've done for the past few years. But if we look at some of the things that we have achieved, I think this is going to lead into the next thing, which I think was announced in the budget. Well, I think we've seen that we've had a number of important motor investments from the motor industry program. We've seen that there have been some important investments in business process services. We've seen that, for example, in the clothing industry, there's been some quite important new relationships being forged with retail, in particular for Shini. But one of the things that comes directly out of our incentive and has become a more generalized lesson for us is the rollout of the clothing and textile competitiveness program, and particularly the production incentive. What happened in the past in the clothing industry, just to remind members, was we had what was called a duty credit certificate system. And it was basically said that if you exported, you would earn a duty credit which would allow you to import. Now, the idea originally was that this was going to be to encourage import of machinery and equipment, and this was going to make the clothing industry much more competitive. In actual fact, most of the clothing industry doesn't export. Only a few export. Neighboring countries in SAARC who export, then they get these duty credit certificates. They haven't been used. They weren't used primarily to import machinery and equipment and raise competitiveness. They were used to sell to retailers who then used them to import more clothing, so that this was, in fact, damaging the industry. So we got rid of that scheme. I must say it was a large debate and discussion and quite a lot of PT in SAARC, but we ended that arrangement and we introduced the new scheme, the production incentive. The production incentive basically says, and this was the basis of research and a lot of consultation with the industry, that the South African clothing industry has a future, but it must raise its competitiveness. It must identify particular niches like fast fashion, like specialized sportswear, some other sporting, tents and things of that sort. It must move into those areas. And to do that, it must also raise its competitiveness. And we found that there was too many cases in the clothing industry of demoralization. Clothing companies didn't want to invest. It was what was called sweating the assets. You just ran the factories on the old machinery and equipment until it broke down or until the cost became excessive. Then you closed the factory and sacked the workers. That was what we had. So we introduced the scheme. A relatively small number of companies took it up. But actually what they did was not only did they preserve jobs, but they grew jobs. They grew jobs. There were 1,000-odd jobs created in the small number of companies that took it up. And I think we say, if we can do this in the clothing industry, for goodness sake, we can do it across more broadly across manufacturing. When we look at the conjuncture we're in now, the way I described it, opportunities, huge potential for Africa and South Africa in Africa in the medium term, in the long term, but an immediate challenge. And we've seen that across the board, manufacturing has been quite severely affected. If you look at PMIs, production managers' indexes, they just measure whether or not you are positive about expansion or contraction. You see they've been hovering around the 50. Below 50 means that you expect contraction. Above 50 means you expect expansion. But they're hovering around the 50 in everywhere in the world, not just in South Africa. And I think the problem that we have, we see, and we've discussed this a lot with manufacturers, is we see we have to build a bit of confidence. The future of manufacturing lies in raising competitiveness. That's what it lies in. And we need to encourage manufacturers to raise competitiveness. Now, some of them look around, they say, well, we don't know, there's Europe and this and that, and they may feel that the environment is not particularly susceptible to that. And we risk, and this has happened in manufacturing, we risk people sweating their assets, running the factories until they're not investing, running the factories until they can no longer competitive, and then close the factories and shut. And then that's the risk that we've faced, and we've seen that in a number of closures. We're also aware of the fact that in the first round of the Great Recession in 2009, we lost 1 million jobs. 200,000 of those were in manufacturing. Quite a big proportional loss. And we are saying to ourselves, we cannot afford to allow manufacturing in this round to become disproportionately affected. Last time round, we had training layoffs, which are still available. Companies that are going to consider layoffs are able to access the funding through the IDC, training layoffs. Some of the companies that made investments in the motor industry accessed those things before they made the investment, started training the workforce. Those are the companies that are moving ahead. So we introduced this thing which was announced in the budget, 5.8 billion rand over the MTEF, Manufacturing Competitiveness Enhancement Program. And we're generalizing the lesson from the clothing industry. This is what we'll be saying. In addition to the other things, there will be rules, there will be it'll be specific, we kind of tilt it in ways which are going to be most beneficial to employment. But essentially we're turning around and saying, we want you to invest, we want you to raise competitiveness, and we will come to the party through this Manufacturing Competitiveness Enhancement Program. And I think that's one of our big programs which we've got coming up. The other one in the area of industrial policy, and it was also mentioned in the budget, and I think it was also mentioned in the notion, special economic zones. This bill is out for public comment. There's a sort of roadshow of activities which are taking place on that bill. The bill will eventually come to Parliament. And what we're trying to say here is we have in place the industrial development zones. We have Kucha, we have East London, we have Richards Bay, we have proclaimed, but it hasn't started operating, the OR Tambo, and then there is also under serious consideration and quite an advanced process, Saldana. Those are the existing industrial development zones. They are all based on ports or airports. They are all orientated to export-orientated industries sitting around export facilities. The main thing you get the concentrated infrastructure, you get the duty-free entry of inputs into export products, you get an additional amount of the 12 iTax incentives. But there's also a number of other possible constructs of special economic zones that are around. There's a menu of special economic zones. Some of them may not be particularly export-orientated industries, linked to some of the infrastructure program, linked to some of the programs in the provinces that provinces have identified. There may be other cases for establishing special economic zones which don't take the same form as the IDZs. And so the bill will provide for the establishment of an advisory body and the possibility for us to designate other special economic zones with other characteristics in place. Simultaneously, we want to address some of the governance issues that have arisen in the SEZs, in the IDZs, some of the lack of clarity about the role of provinces, municipalities, national government, the operators of these IDZs. We want to clarify that, and then we want to provide a framework for a regular funding of these SEZs, and you'll see that the budget announced an amount of money that's available to that. And the minister also said that we will be engaging on a tax incentive, an additional tax incentive for the SEZ. So So I think those are some of the issues that were raised in the State of the Nation and the budget. I think that are particularly pertinent to us. Let me then just say a few words about the State of the Nation was broad-based black economic empowerment. And that is something which is, again, will take the form of a bill, but simultaneously with the bill, there will be a rejigging of the codes. And I think that what we have felt is that, one, just to reaffirm, broad-based black economic empowerment remains an imperative in South Africa, not just for reasons of equity or for political reasons, but also economic reasons. By empowering our people, we will create more people productive in the economy, and we will create a major boost for economic growth in South Africa. But we have seen, I think, a number of problems with the BEE process as it's unfolded. One of them is we've seen far too many people participating as what I think we can call passive shareholders, that you get involved in. You receive some shares, you get some benefit of some sort, and there's nothing else. You're not involved in the company on the board as a significant player. You are simply there as a compliance. And we've seen that one of the issues at fault here is the question of fronting. Fronting is we understand fronting as I think most of us, as you take the gardener. You call the gardener the CEO, and you say the company is a black-owned company, and it's not. But fronting is much, much bigger than that. Fronting is taking the form of what's called, and this is some of the research, some of the input we had from the BEE Advisory Council, is some of the fronting is what we could call complex fronting. I think it's a little bit akin to tax evasion. You know, you get presented with a contract. Their lawyers are better than your lawyers. You don't know what it all means. You think you've got certain benefits, but actually when you look at it in the small print, you're reduced to a passive shareholder. You're reduced to in a position where you're not playing a role. You may be wittingly involved in this. You may not care. You may actually be an active collaborator in this. But what it means in terms of the economy is it means those people are not active players in the industry concerned. And we're not getting BEE to make people active players. So if you're in an engineering company, become an active manager of an engineering company. We're not getting that on a sufficient scale. So we're trying to address that matter in the bill. We will set up a commission. The commission will be empowered to receive complaints, and it will also be empowered to be proactive. There's a definition of fronting in the bill. The moment the only remedy is the common law offense of fraud, which it is fraud. You're presenting yourself as though you're black owned, but it's more complicated as a common law offense. We'll be introducing that bill. Simultaneously with that is we have felt that empowerment, although there are provisions in the scorecard for broad elements, things like enterprise development, for supplier capacity development and so on, our research is telling us that there's far too little involvement by many big companies there. And that's linked to another question that we want to raise, that we've been raising in small business development. The problem we have in South Africa is we don't have what you have in Asia, a symbiotic relationship between big and small business. We have far too many big businesses rooted in their old suppliers, and they don't go out and support small businesses. In Asia, you go to small business suppliers, you don't want bad suppliers, so you help them to improve their capacity, and that's what we need to try to get. So what we're going to say in the scorecard, we'll be amending the scorecard, there'll be regulations. This won't be in the amendment itself. We're going to say, for certain companies over a certain threshold, you'll be required to score a certain minimum in this area. And if you don't, we'll give you a discount or a haircut, if you prefer, a haircut off your overall score. So you won't be able to come along and say, I'm a BEE player of a high magnitude if you are only involved in passive share transactions. That's what we're trying to say. We must have a much more active empowerment of our people. That's what we're trying to do. And the same then comes over into small business, where we're trying to say that we're going to be emphasizing much more the aspects of incubation, where we have seen that those are where we receive real benefits. Those are the programs where I think that, that small businesses benefit from the most. The problem in South Africa is that we don't have enough of it. And so we will be using other mechanisms, including the social dialogue and the new growth path, to try to encourage a much more active involvement in those areas. Let me then just talk about, very briefly, about some of the trade and investment relations that we're trying to build. I think arising from what I've already said, the African continent as a major growth prospect means that we have got to become much more engaged in the issues of African development. And we have already been players. We're players in SADC. One of the projects I think you all know is the tripartite process. We hosted the summit last year. This is to create the free trade agreement between SADC, COMESA, East African Community, basically with a focus on extending the kinds of things that we offer to people within each of our regions across those regional borders. 27 countries, including Southern Sudan, players in this. $1 trillion combined US dollars GDP, and 700 million people, half the African continent. But we said that this has to be a development integration program. This is not just a trade integration thing, because many of the barriers to intra-regional trade are not just tariff matters. They're trade facilitation matters, the efficiency of borders, other measures that are in place. They are also inadequate infrastructure. Simply to trade between ourselves and Uganda, for example, you have to hike everything down to the port of Mombasa, which is clogged, and then bring the stuff down. It's not an opportunity for fresh produce trade between ourselves and Uganda, even though Uganda is an incredibly fertile country on the African continent. It's also questions of supply capacity, because although a country like Uganda is very, very fertile, produces a lot, the quality, because they're small-scale farmers, are very often not competitive in our market. So we work with them on things like that. But in the tripartite arrangement, we've said infrastructure, and there's the North-South project, which is 80-odd projects, building a road-rail connection from Central Africa down through across the Chirunda border post between Zimbabwe and Zambia, across the bike bridge into the port of Durban. Another program which we are very actively working on is the Trans-Kuneni Spatial Development Initiative, which is from central Angola through Namibia and to link up with the Trans-Kalahari. And this would build a road-rail connection to South Africa, and would be another route for us to engage with the most fastest growing economy in SADC. The African Union also wants to extend the tripartite into a continental FTA. There was a discussion about that at the summit that took place in January. And it's now been referred for further work and further discussion, and will be discussed again at the summit that will take place in, I think it's July or June, middle of the year. And those are things that we work on. We're working towards this because we think that the regional market, the development of the regional market in Africa, the infrastructure program, the FTA, the trade facilitation, and the cooperation about the development of the productive sectors is all very necessary to turn what we see as a growth spurt in Africa into a developmental and industrialization effort across the African continent. And that's the challenge that we face. What you will see in the next IPAP, one of the new elements, just to give you a preview, is that we are engaging quite energetically in SACU, in SADC, in the tripartite, and the continent on how we, as South Africa, as the most industrialized country in sub-Saharan Africa, how do we work and cooperate in promoting mutually beneficial, equitable industrialization? And in particular, how can we make sure our own industrialization fits in with and stimulates in a mutually beneficial way industrialization efforts across the continent? So that's something that is going to come out in that regard. Just on the BRICS, the BRICS, our membership of the BRICS, I think came at a very, very propitious moment because the BRICS were more or less at the point of starting to discuss a program of intra-BRICS cooperation. And what we were able to do was get in at the right moment to start to be part of these discussions. The BRICS has, of course, been an arrangement where those countries, and we have also been part of this, have been working together around the governance of the international economy and things of that sort. We've been working closely with the BRICS countries and the WTO, things of that sort. But now is a discussion of how do we promote intra-BRICS trade and how do we promote intra-BRICS investment. And I think you'll see there's a number of very interesting projects that have been discussed. There's an ICT connection, but there's also a series of proposals around how can we build our trade without resort to third country currencies. How can we build our trade without resort to convertible currencies as we do at the moment? And then our approach has been, and just to give a little bit of a highlight, building on the Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Agreement with China, there were two very important commitments. China accepted that we have a structural imbalance in our trade in which we are supplying primary products to them and importing value-added products. So we gave them a list of 10 value-added products which we said we could supply into China, and we agreed with them that they would host and support some trade exhibitions that were focusing on these value-added products. We took that to Shanghai and Beijing last year. We basically said this is not the public off the street, these are actual investors and buyers. And we have, in fact, a number of very exciting prospects of investment as well as trade opportunities that are beginning to emerge as a result of that. And this is something that we want to push. Finally, on the trade front, let me just say that we are also looking quite energetically. I just come back myself from Turkey and Saudi Arabia. But also last year, the president went to, and I also went with the president, we went to the UAE, United Arab Emirates, and to Oman. And I think we are looking in the course of this year to try to strengthen our relations, our trade investment and bilateral cooperation arrangements, not just with the BRICS in Africa, but other fast-growing emerging economies. The Gulf is one, and ASEAN is another. And in particular, we are developing quite an intensive dialogue with our counterparts in Indonesia, and we're looking to try to build on that to advance trade and economic cooperation arrangements. So as government, as the DTI, I think we are opening a number of new doors. Our challenge is going to be we need to get our business people also to be able to follow up with that in promoting mutually beneficial relations across the world, and in particular to take advantage of our positioning in the world economy as it's unfolding. As I said before, I think we're in a very, very good space in the medium term. So we're trying then this year, this will be the focus, trying to address some matters which will build and support confidence so that our manufacturers will invest and will raise competitiveness, and in the medium and longer term to position ourselves in the African continent and in relation to other emerging economies in ways that are going to yield us benefits, we think, in the medium term, given what I said right at the beginning about the expectations of where emerging economies are going to be in the world in the next few decades. So let me stop there. Let me just see if the last slide, by the way, is some indication of our budget. You'll see there's been a fairly sizable increase in our budget allocation, which in particular for economic competitiveness, those are the figures split of the 5.8 billion for the manufacturing competitiveness enhancement program, and then those are the figures for the special economic zones. I think that's more or less it. I don't know whether the DG wants to add anything. Or anybody else in the team, but that's a kind of an overview, I think, from our side.
Thank you very much, then, Minister. So, members of the committee, comments, questions, clarification. In that order, yes, we're taking you, well, right, you down near the bottom, eh? Sandwiched between the journalists. That's Honourable Oriani Ambrosini, Honourable Khadebe, Honourable Mombasa, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable James. In that order. A reminder about the 2 minute issue. Avoid preamble.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you, Minister, through you, Madam Chairman. Sorry for being late. One comment which may prompt a question if the Minister is so inclined to answer it, and one direct question. Comment. In the late 80s, in the 90s, the International Freedom Foundation had a big map marking all the countries in the world in terms of how communist they were, in deep red all the way to deep blue for free countries. South Africa was in orange and was classified as a socialist country during the apartheid time. From a strictly economic viewpoint. I accept what the minister said about the habit of the South African company, the large one, to maintain their supply side, their supply chains, and not to constantly look for alternatives which are cheaper and better. In Asia, doesn't happen. Correct. People are constantly looking for cheaper alternatives, and they do not exist, that they create them by empowering new and cheaper and better people. Looking at this problem, the minister seems, in this case, as in many other cases, to resort to what seems to me a very similar socialist, apartheid-minded approach to the problem, and that is government intervening to force the businesses to employ somebody else, rather than removing that lack of competition, which enables them to be inefficient, which enables them to stay in the position they're in without looking for cheaper and better suppliers. I look at this mindset across all the government policies, but this is comment if the minister wishes to comment. Direct question. The question I asked your Director General Minister was not answered. I have a reason to believe, and there are insistent reports, that the U.S. government will not renew the American Growth Opportunity Act. We are dealing about BRICS, and we see the benefits of BRICS. If we consider the enormous damage to the country, if this is not renewed, and what type of lobbying has been done. The two reasons given, one is the U.S. reason that we are a middle-income class, and that's something where lobbying is required, and the other one is that we are in breach of the bad treatment clause. What is your department doing about it? What happens if companies like Parmalat, which probably came here on account of this opportunity, pull out, and what would be the recessionary effect of that?
Thank you, Honorable Khadebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the first comment I'll make is to appreciate the input from the minister. And the second one is to create the historical fact here, which was issued by the member, that the apartheid socialist mentality, apartheid and socialism were mutually exclusive. You cannot mesh the two. I think that one must be corrected from the word go. Chair, I think that what a person has seen on the budget and both the State of the Nation address is the appreciation of the work which is done by the Department of Trade and Industry. I think the follow-up of the budget is very clear that you cannot have an increase of 32% in a single year. It shows that there's some good work which is done within that industry. But, Chair, what I'm afraid of is what this Parliament has adopted. We adopted a position on industrialization, in particular when coming to the issue of manufacturing. In that report of the Industrial Policy Action Plan, which was adopted by Parliament, not noted, was that we are going to push for the creation of small steel mills, whereby we are going to beneficiate the iron ore, which we are getting from from Thabazimbi and Sishen, so that the all the other products around those areas can be processed so that we sell out the high value goods. But what I've seen in the State of the Nation address is that the Sishen Saldanha line, its capacity is going to increase to export the iron ore from 60 million tons per annum to about 100,000. Is that not undermining the very thing which is adopted by our parliament? Number two, Chair, there's a very same parliament adopted the developmental trade policy, whereby we spoke about the issue of zero rating, considering the tariffs on the products which are going to have an input on our exports. I think that the special economic zones are really addressing that. Né? That's why it is highly appreciated. That's why that other one is actually in conflict with the other one. So I think if we can get further clarity around that one, I'll really appreciate it. On the issue of the competitiveness funds, né, will that cover the issue of the human resource? Because when you go to these companies, they only put the machinery which is going to make them effective. But at the end of the day, behind that machinery, you need the people who are good procurement managers. As the ministers acknowledge that in the government, we don't have that. But also in the private sector, we are lacking in that. So will that this competitiveness fund also be able to enhance that? On the issue of the green industry, I didn't see the emphasis. Will this money also leverage the company so that they can produce green industry? Because I think it's the way forward for this country. Thank you, Chair.
Also expressing appreciation, Colleague Chair. My first point is when we look at the small industries, the SMMEs, we should also in particular create space for cooperatives so that when those players grow, they also do that in a broadening sideways manner. And that also addresses, also contributes in addressing the inequalities. So that even when we speak of assisting small business in terms of producing qualitatively, the SMMEs, consciously, we should also count them in. And we should also, I suggest, work closely with the Department of Higher Education with respect to what universities and technicons produce, in terms of their outputs as universities, so that those products relate to the developmental needs that the minister has articulated. The last point is that I think it is a good point that as South Africa, we are taking all steps to unify Africa, especially economically, because if we don't do that, we will find that the other major players will play one African country against another, one region against the other, so that, you know, that will also lead to our demise. So expressing appreciation at that attitude. Thanks, Colleague Chair.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you to the Minister for the presentation. Minister, the World Economic Forum's Competitiveness Report 2011 lists in its survey on the most problematic factors for doing business in sub-Saharan Africa five factors before we get to infrastructure. Infrastructure is only the sixth most important factor. Now, obviously, SONA and the budget have focused largely on the provision of infrastructure, and that is absolutely welcome. Infrastructure is necessary, but as we well know and as this study shows, it's certainly not sufficient. We also had the harrowing story last month from ShopRite, who tell us that for them to get one truck between here and Zambia, just one supply truck, they need to complete 1,600 separate pieces of paper, 1,600 separate forms. Now, Minister, you spoke a lot about expanding South African trade in the continent. The fact of the matter is there's a great deal of things other than functioning railways and great roads that need to be worked on. Is the department focusing on making the non-financial costs of doing business with South Africa and the rest of the continent much easier? Because as this report shows and as experience tells us, actually that is one of the biggest obstacles to development.
Thank you. Honourable Jane.
Thank you, Chair. I have two questions for Minister Davies. The one has to do with the efficiencies in moving goods through our ports of entry, and whether there's a project, in fact, to improve efficiencies. We know that they vary by port. We know we've indexed the time it takes to get goods out globally, and we don't do very well compared to some of our big partners. So, but the question is whether there are actual projects to enhance efficiencies. And the second one, on the governance questions when it comes to IDZs and SEZs, there has been a problem, it seems to me, speaking to some investors about the lack of a one-stop shop when it comes to large investments. In the Rotterdam Harbour, for example, in talking to all of the players when it comes to Saldanha Bay, had great difficulty in actually dealing with a single minister on that question. And I mean, we've got three economically related ministries, and we have some of the SOE, Transnet is an issue in this as well. So, in any case, but the question is whether there is a project to have a one stop shop when it comes to large investments. Thank you.
I'm just looking at the Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just want to thank the Minister for his presentation, and I think combined with what the Minister of Finance had to say on Wilderness Day and with the State President's speech, I think the important thing is that these three very important ministers are, and the President are giving South Africa a vision. And I think with a vision, as the Bible says, without a vision the people perish. Give them a vision and they flourish. And I think when you give people a vision, then they'll run with the ball. Now, I don't have quite as laissez-faire attitude as my colleague, Dr. Mario Ambrosini, but I think he's making the point that South Africans know how to run with a ball, and one of them to hit it, it seems, in New Zealand. But the point is, free us up, and I think you've got plenty of things in place. We've got BRICS. We've got so much going for us that I think we must see ourselves as government or people involved in government as being handmaidens. So I must say I'm excited about it. And I think the important thing is that out of mining, you will get all these things happening. I mean, we must never forget we are the most skewed country in the world because of the mines in Johannesburg. I mean, where in the world do you have the biggest conurbation? Because it's built around mining. And if you really want to see it, read a book called Diamonds, Gold, and War by Meredith. It's a delightful read, and it's a good history of mining in South Africa. But my last question, it's a question, Madam Chair, is I come from a small country area. I think nowadays we call them deep rural areas. And it's a town called Estcourt. We have make the famous Estcourt sausages there. We also do Masonite and all your Nescafe and Rick Coffee and Milo is also made there. We also have an offset investment in Carbotech in Estcourt. But we've got a very keen mayor there, and he wants to see the area develop. How can that mayor access the SEZ, the developments? And maybe it's a little premature. I know there's just a bill. But maybe, Mr. Minister, one of your staff or somebody could contact me, and I can try to put our mayor in Estcourt in touch with him, and maybe he can tell us how we can do that.
But I have a question myself, but I do know the area you're talking about, Honourable McIntosh. I know that area very well. The energy issue, Minister. I keep on raising this with respect to industrialization, and I am happy to hear that it's totally acknowledged by government, both the President himself, of course, and the respective ministers, including yourself. But what alarms me more recently when one reads certain things, which of course one is yet to check on and so on, but it would appear as if some smelters are being closed and reasons given, is to curb the demand on an overburdened electricity grid. Now, as I say, I haven't done my own checking yet, but there seem to be numerous of these comments in relation to industry and energy. And perhaps you could share with us what the department and the other clusters of ministers involved in resolving that issue. Thank you. So, Minister, it's over to yourself now to try and address those issues.
Okay, well, thanks very much. I think, first of all, I think the Honourable Khadebi made the point, which I agree with, in response to the Honourable Ambrosini's comments. I don't know what if someone is classifying 1980s apartheid South Africa socialist. I think there's a hugely loaded agenda there, and I don't think I want to comment any further on that. Let me just say on the AGOA, the review of AGOA, we are energetically engaging in that, as we are engaging with our fellow countries and who were AGOA recipients, AGOA beneficiaries. And our position, our common position, is that we want to see a rollover of the current AGOA for a reasonable period of time. I think that we do think that there is a prospect of us achieving that because there are views in U.S. Congress. I mean, this is where we get into the details of the U.S. governance system. It's not just the administration we have to talk to, it's Congress. There are views like that in Congress, and we're trying to build on some of those views. And I think the what's also in our favor to some degree is there's not a coherent alternative emerging. But if there is, it would be to say that certain countries who are considered emerging economies would be graduated out, and I think that we know that we would be that, and we would be the first category. But I think there's a solidarity in the African position about trying to just roll it over as it is. So that's where we are trying to work towards. On that, we think it has been beneficial, and that I think one of our messages would be that surely we shouldn't be the moment a trade opening to support development and job creation in developing countries achieves some success, you close it off. It shouldn't be like that, and it's only available so long as it doesn't achieve any results. So I think that that is our message as South Africa, and certainly we are involved in the in trying to put that message forward. Then, just to say on Honourable Khadebi's point, well, I think there's two sources of iron ore in South Africa. The mini mill technology or small mill technology would largely be byproducts of other mining which takes place on the Highveld. The majority of the iron ore we have in South Africa is there, and it would use a different technology, and I think there's a number of projects that are seeking to build on that. The Sishen-Saldanha issue is not unconnected with us continuing to seek the return of 21.4% of the output of Sishen available at a developmental price, and we say cost plus 3% is the starting point or the benchmark for that, to support competitive steel manufacturing in South Africa. It's not delinked. And I think in the bigger iterations of the PICC, I think that will become clearer. But yes, we are willing to work on that mine. on that line, rather, the Oryx line. We're willing to work on that, to upgrade that infrastructure. But that doesn't mean that we say to hell with the idea that a 21.4% of that output must support competitive steel manufacturing in South Africa. It's not delinked. On green industries, green industrialization continues to be a major focus for us. I must say that when we talk about competitiveness, I had the opportunity during COP17 to open a Unilever factory, a Donsi factory outside Durban. And this was told to me to be the most advanced agro-processing plant in the Unilever stable, and very likely the most advanced plant in the world, agro-processing plant. They produce various spices and condiments in that factory. And Unilever is committed to moving further, and also they see us as a base for the African continent, by the way. So I think there's a tremendously important thing. But the element of that becoming the most advanced plant is that it's green, that it uses half the electricity of other competitor plants. It doesn't take any water off the grid. It recycles the water, and it doesn't use a landfill. So I think that this is to say to me that an element, a very significant element of being competitiveness, is to go green. We have another project which we also highlighted during COP17. There is a standard, an international standard, I can't remember the number, ISO something, SAN something, a standard, which is around energy efficiency. And there's a pilot project which the DTI is leading to get companies to achieve levels of energy efficiency, and then you qualify for that standard. Now, I think that can be a very important tool which we can use to incentivize companies in various ways around energy saving. And it will be something that you can use to try to access all kinds of benefits across the world that you're meeting that standard and you're achieving energy saving. Some of it is really quite simple stuff, like, you know, turning the lights off and things of that sort, and making sure that we do have to go in for demand management and reduce our carbon footprint, and that is a significant element of competitiveness. That's in addition to the green industries. We launched it again at COP17. It was on the fringes of that. It was in the IPAP. We launched this thing called the South African Renewables Initiative, which is now taken over by the Ministry of Energy, Department of Energy. And basically, you know, something like a quarter of the new electricity that will be generated in South Africa will come from renewable sources. That's a big commitment. And we made a big commitment because we think that that is the scale to support industrial development. And we've been saying that, you know, everyone is saying that the next wave of industrialization and innovation will be about green. It will be greener factories. It won't just be about electricity generation. It will be renewable energy generation, but it will be greener factories. It will be energy-saving vehicles. It will be all of that. And that actually what has happened is that if this is the next wave of industrialization, Africa and South Africa must be involved in this, not just as service providers of somebody else's technology, as we are in cell phones, which is the last wave of industrialization, but we must also be manufacturers. So that's where we try to position ourselves around that, and I think that there are some serious work going on around that. And when we come up with the IPAP, I think you'll see where we want to move on that. The Honourable Mbassa is quite right about co-ops. I should say on the co-ops, that's another bill that's coming here, the co-ops amendment bill. It's in with the state law advisors, and we're trying to hurry them up because that bill actually might be further forward than the other two pieces of legislation. So that bill will be there. That bill will create a series of support measures for co-ops, which is based on a very, very important, I think, conceptual distinction. We've treated in the past co-ops as a subset of small business. Co-ops is a different form of economic organization. It can be big or small. And it has particular opportunities in South Africa, and I think there are particular industries and sectors which you can identify. And we've been trying to say that there must be much more of a breaking down of silos between industrial development and the promotion of co-ops. For example, in agro industries, one of the projects is the the creation of small mills, small maize mills. There's a new technology, and that you can create maize mills, smaller maize mills, which can produce mini meal of high quality. And this is one of our projects in agro-processing industries to roll that out. Now, if you look at our own experience of South Africa in the past, and also the experience of countries like Kenya, co-ops have worked quite well in agro-processing. And for example, I went to a very large dairy project in Kenya with the deputy president, and the farmers, the dairy farmers, are not cooperativized. But the factory that produces the pasteurizes the milk, makes the yogurt, makes the cheese and all that. A sizable plant is a co-op. It's the same in South Africa. The KWV, when it was a co-op, the grape farmers were not cooperativized, but the winemaking was. And so there's an opportunity there, for example, for the maize milling, the small maize milling, for co-ops to be formed and established in that area. And there's a number of other such opportunities, I think, that are emerging. So we're trying to identify those opportunities concretely in terms of our industrial policy, as well as try to address how do we support cooperatives wherever they may be, whichever sector they may operate in, and so on. On the question, Honourable Hill Lewis, I don't think we ever said that infrastructure on the African continent is the only thing, but it is one of the serious keys. I mean, trade facilitation is the phrase that covers a lot of what you say, which is, you know, other regulations, cross-border regulations, things of that sort. And trade facilitation is very firmly on the agenda in SADC, is very firmly on the agenda in the tripartite and so on. I think we know that there are all of these problems. And one of the projects which has been undertaken in the framework of the North-South Corridor is the Chirundu border post between Zimbabwe and Zambia. Now, I think if you look at border posts, you look at, for example, even Bike Bridge, there's a combination of hard infrastructure investment that needs to be made, and then also a question of rationalization of procedures and reducing red tape. There's a few things that are needed. On Bike Bridge, for example, the traffic only goes one way at any one time. We need it to be able to go two ways. You need to kind of harmonize computer systems and stuff like that. But on the Chirundu border post, they've actually reduced the time of crossing to a few hours as a combination of those things. We've been developing things like one-stop shops, which operates on the Mozambique border for some years. And I think those sorts of things are ways we can address that. But, of course, we need to understand that and try to reduce some of the pressure. It's to do with things like harmonization of road traffic permits, recognition of each other's driving licenses. I mean, there are all kinds of things like that which cover a multitude of government departments. But the infrastructure is also fundamental. Infrastructure is fundamental. If you look at the map of Africa and you see where the railway lines go, they go from the mine to the port and then the products go outside. They don't connect us north-south. And we find that, for example, if you want to trade, as I said, with Uganda, you want to trade with Angola, you have to go by sea to the port. The port is clogged. We don't have road and rail connections on a sufficient scale, things like that. So the infrastructure is important. And so is the production. If we talk about what it is that means that our trade is still very unbalanced with our neighbors, we don't want it to be like that. But we still have a huge trade imbalance with our neighbors. Now, it's not tariffs, because since 2005, 98% of products which were from SADC enter the South African market duty-free. There's not tariffs. It's either that they don't have the production capacity to produce goods which are competitive on the South African market, which is often the case, or secondly, there's an infrastructure problem, or both. Those are usually the things. So I think that we're aware of those issues. We are trying to achieve them in the framework of what we call trade facilitation. That's where they're addressed. Customs cooperation, cooperation of all these other. These are ongoing things on the regular agendas of our organisations. And I mean, we do push as South Africa to try to reduce the red tape and the problems that are there. Then on the question of the overall the ports. look, it's efficiencies and also the costs in the ports. And I mean, this is actually part of the infrastructure program that is part of the PICC, is addressing precisely that question. I think we know that this is a factor, and that you know, there are some anomalies as well. That the cheapest rate you get in the port is when you export raw materials. You pay a higher charge when you export value-added products. So we're trying to address some of those matters, among other things as well. And are we? We do try to have our agency TISA, part of the DTI, not an agency, part of the DTI, Trade Investment South Africa. We do try to provide a one-stop shop facility in the sense that TISA will engage with all the other regulatory departments that are required if there's an investment that's ongoing. But the thing about Saldanha and the issue of UAL, for example, I don't know if you're referring to UAL, the UAL case, we escalated the oil and gas service program to be a national program precisely because we need to have a national vision of oil and gas servicing and not just a local or specific port vision of this. And that is because, you know, it's not unique to South Africa. I found this when I went on a visit to another port. I won't say where. But very often port operators don't think that dry dock services are their core business, and they don't prioritize those things. They think that their core business is the vessels coming in, load the vessels, send them out again. This other thing is a detraction, but yet that actually can create lots of jobs, lots of industrial opportunities, and so on. And in the best cases, in fact, some countries even waive the dry dock fees because they see the importance of attracting the vessels. So we intervened on that case, and I think it's a discussion with Portnet to try to get this broader understanding of the value of that kind of work. Certainly as the DTI, we are strongly committed to promoting that. In fact, in the last IPAP, we're saying that we see the oil and gas service opportunities not just on the West Coast and in the West Coast ports, but also on the East Coast, where you've seen a huge number of new gas projects emerging. So that's what we want to do on that. On Honourable McIntosh's point about the SEZ, look, I think at this point we haven't got the SEZ framework in, which would be broader than just the ports and the airports. But I think the prime target would be that provinces have all identified some particular focused activity that they want to support, and some of that is susceptible to the SEZ model. So I think that the sort of first port of call would more likely be provinces than it would be municipalities. So I think that would be the sort of way we would envisage it. But we still have to get the bill through. We have to set up the advisory body. So I mean, it's not at this point in time. I think the municipality of Escort would be welcome to engage with the DTI about how we can support various projects which may be going on in Escort. I think agro-processing industries, I know, I've heard of some of the issues there. There are municipal issues. I've heard people talk about the municipal issues and the regularity of supply of municipal services is a factor determining location. So I think we need to address all of those. And then the last one, your question, Chair, on smelters. Look, I think we make a distinction between smelters which are smelting somebody else's ore, which we bring in and all we do is supply the electricity, and smelter projects which are linked to beneficiation. But we have had to say some time ago, and this was one of the things in Kucha, there was an idea there was going to be an aluminium smelter. Now, the aluminium was not going to come from, or rather the bauxite was not going to come from South Africa. It was going to probably come from Australia. Go in there, be smelted, use our electricity. We don't have cheap electricity on that scale to offer any longer. I think we've had to be frank about that. But we're not saying that every... I mean, some of the beneficiation programs of our own resources do require... those are the things we'll prioritize. That's the point. I think we do know that the energy price is a significant factor for many manufacturers, and I think the president indicated that we're reviewing that again. I think we know that another round of very heavy price increases for energy will have some impact on manufacturing, and I think we're trying to work towards mitigating that. But I think on the other side of it, as I said already, we will also be looking to try to see if we can promote much more energy saving by manufacturing. That's an element of their competitiveness, and we have a number of tools, I think, in our toolbox which we can use there as well. Thanks.
Are there a couple of members who didn't ask any questions? Would they like to take up that time now? We have then, of course, Honourable Salah, Honourable Khwabasa, another opportunity, Honourable Ambrosini, Honourable Khadebe, Honourable Mabasa. Now, this time, of course, we'd like to make them sharper, very sharp, sort of 1 minute. But of course, those who haven't asked, do take your couple of minutes.
Chairperson, thank you for the opportunity. But just like all my colleagues, I'm also wishing to express my excitement over the educational and encouraging presentation the minister has made. Chair, we are aware that this will not be without challenges. There will be challenges, as the minister said, around legislative, around harmonization of policies and legislation within different countries, skills and capacity, and other challenges. So obviously we're not expecting a smooth sail in this regard. I have developed particular interest with the Asian countries, and I would like to ask a couple of questions, just two questions. One, these top 10 projects and the top 10 value-added export products, is it possible to give us more information as to what they are, which projects they are, and which products are we referring to? The other one is engagement of the fast-growing emerging economies in Asia, actually around Arab Gulf and the Asian countries. Is there any particular specific focus towards a few of them that could be mentioned to us? I'm saying this because very recently I visited two countries in that area, and I've seen a lot of interest in South Africa.
Honourable Khwabasa.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. I want to express appreciation particularly where the minister talks about the symbiotic relationship between the big companies and the small companies. But I want to focus my attention on the infrastructure project, the infrastructure program. So the test of the success of this infrastructure program is going to lie on the extent to which the traditional big companies, your Group 5 and so on, are going to be able to take along with them, and the government in this instance has got to play a very critical and visible role in taking the smaller emerging, particularly black companies, along with them, so that by the time we reach the middle of implementing this program, we are able to say that more
and bigger black companies have emerged are sustainable and can take on big, big government projects. And they're not fronting, Comrade Joe reminds me. And I want, therefore, to say, in the government's plan, can we get a very a clear clarity on whether that part of the implementation of this huge infrastructure program is part of the plan? Because we need to consciously do that. We need to consciously ensure that black companies emerge out of this program. But also, what are the new economic activities that are going to emerge out of this program? In addition to infrastructure, because certainly there are going to be other economic activities arising out of this. What are those? Chairperson, the next issue related to this is that the test of the success of this program is going also to arise from the manner in which this program is integrated to rural development, so that you don't see the infrastructure program projects going on in and between the big cities, but that is not linked to rural development. And therefore, we must be careful that there is coordination, particularly between the current projects that are going on and the new projects that are going to link up with rural development. Lastly, Chairperson, very quickly, I think that addressing the triple challenges of poverty, employment, and inequalities through this program should not just mean the creation of jobs alone, but so that people wait to be employed, but that people must themselves begin to create employment opportunities. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The Minister has kindly, fully, and correctly answered my first concern in respect of the of AGOA. Thank you very much. I share the view. But he has provided no answer in respect of the second one, which was the concern vented on the Hill that South Africa has breached the best treatment clause in respect of various countries, especially the EU. Question, is that true or false, somewhere in between? And if it is true, can it be corrected before the renewal comes up? And do we want to correct it? Second, a comment, Madam Chairman, Unilever. Yes, Unilever came, set up the plant. Going green is good business. They did it because it's good business, not because of regulation. I do agree with the Honorable McIntosh. The greatest unexploited mine of this country is the free market potential. There is so much that can be done if one unleashes these great forces. And perhaps within IPAP and the mindset of DTI, there should be a little more of let them pass through. The greatest new technology, where the industrial turnaround is going to take place, is going to be biotechnology and nanotechnology, on which we are making no investments. We went to see the Bosch factory on photovoltaic panels. They started in the late 80s. They flourished in the 90s. in 2012 their sale into the world. We had the opportunity of getting their subsidiary in South Africa. They looked at the marketplace, they saw the instability, the regulation, a thousand reasons not to do business in South Africa, and they went to Malaysia. We could have had that right here. So we have lost many opportunities trying to catch up with the green energy industrialization program and products, maybe a lost opportunity. Where we still have a great opportunity is in respect of biotechnology and nanotechnology, on which we are making no investments. And I made this point several times, and the minister 2 years ago in reply said, yes, that's something that we will be looking at. Actually, that was my maiden speech. And I'd like to know whether, because I don't see anything mentioned in any of the documents, whether he has looked it up and eventually decide to give it up.
Honourable Hadebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. On the issue of being privately South African and the issue of the coordination between the department and SARS in particular, take for example, last year we got a presentation from the standard SADS, Standards Authority of South Africa, when they were dealing with the issue of the loss of skills in the port of entry, whereby the foreign companies end up being the one again who certifies the products which they are moving up. I think that what is the department going to do this year to rectify that problem? In particular, taking into consideration that the panel which was set by the United Nations, which is going to investigate the issue of fraud which is happening against South Africa and Africa, whereby about South Africa is losing about 24 billion rand per annum in the form that the platinum is being at the port of exit. Platinum is being put in the customs as tin. So that it means that instead of this platinum working for us, bringing forex to us, we are losing it. So I think that the Department of Treasury and Industry has got the responsibility of ensuring that all the companies, foreign and South African, that firstly they must be proudly South African to ensure that we have a buy-in from them so that we grow the economy of South Africa. Because if the businesses can do that, then we are in real trouble. That's why I was very relieved on Wednesday when we interacted with BUSA, which also indicated that they are committed to the programs which we are having as the government. Take example, multilateralism, industrialization, developmental trade policy. But if some of their members will be doing those things, it means literally they are disseminating the country. So what is the department doing around that in order to do that? And then with the sanctions against Iran around the corner, what is being done to protect the South African companies and then to shield the economy from those shocks? Thank you.
Honourable Mabasa. These are all the seconders.
Thanks, on the issue of fronting, I'm thinking that we should explore making it a criminal offence, but there should be consequences to fronting. And then the second one is that in terms of communication, big industries are up to scratch, or they are up to date with what we communicate as government, even the opportunities that we communicate, because technologically they are more advanced, they have people who are just specializing on communication, but the small business, strategies are we as a department utilizing to make sure that we don't leave them far behind, because if we can have the unintended consequences of finding that with information we are empowering the empowered and at the detriment of those that are small. My last one is that I think we should explore ways of formalizing informal business so that it doesn't stay outside whether we call it a circumference, but so that the benefits that go to organized industry also accrue to those that have been outside. Because when they are outside, even their behavior does not, they don't strive to do necessarily the right things because they think they are daughters or sons.
Honorable James.
Thank you, Chair. Just two very quick follow-up questions. The first is whether, I presume there's ongoing research on efficiencies of clearing customs and so on through the ports, and also the cost, what the cost structures are. It would be very good to have access to that data if, by the Chair, we could ask for, to actually have the look at the numbers when it comes to South African ports. The second is, you must have a measure for the efficiency by which TISA actually operates in terms of the number of projects that come through it and what the ratio is between those that are facilitated and those are not. I'm not sure what kind of measure you use to assess whether TISA, in fact, is working or not. But I certainly would like to see what those numbers look like as well. Thanks.
Honorable Hill Lewis, you know, our practice is put your hands up when we call for a second round. But as you're new to our committee, we'll give you this leeway on this occasion. Thank you.
Much appreciated, Chair. Just a question specifically on the budget for the department. I looked through the vote in the estimates of national expenditure, and I see there's an amount of, I think, 50 million allocated to the National Consumer Commission. Now, we had the NCC here last week, in fact, and they were highlighting the very acute resource problems that they had this year, and of course their budget vote has increased. I wonder, though, given the extremely important function that Commissioner Motlala and her team now serve, whether it could not be considered to offer them slightly more resources than which they've been allocated.
Much. Minister, yes, you indicated to me that after this response you'll highlight a couple of the budget issues. Is that correct?
Let me just say, first of all, I think we can make the list of the 10 products here and make that available. Unless you've got them, DG's got them. Do you want to read them out?
I think the same question was asked at the last meeting, but I think, as we said, we've got a list of 10 products which we handed to, which I think our Minister and Deputy President handed over to China in October last year. And those are, firstly, there's the agro-processing products like wines and the cereals. There's the chemical products, butanol. There's plastic products, propylene. There's various stainless steel products. There's aluminium products, alloys and coils, which we've included, and then there's a number of automotive components, including tooling, and then on the capital equipment side, there's a vast array of mining equipment and mining safety equipment, and then on the manufacturing side, there's industrial pumps and so on. We've got that list. In addition to that, we also put together for our China visit, and it raises the question about the IDZs. We put it together 10 top investment projects where countries can invest. So we've combined the work of some of the IDZs that we have and some of their projects and looked at some of our projects, and we've also, and shortly we've published this top 10 products that's on our website and we can distribute it. We'll do the same with our top 10 investment products soon.
Okay, and just to say that list has gone from the very top of the Chinese government down. It's well known, and it was the basis of an exhibition that was held there. The DG was participating in that, and I was involved in the handing out of the list to everybody who needs to know from the Chinese. Quickly on the areas, you see, I think that it's not just us that are seeking out the fast-growing economies. The other fast-growing economies are seeking us out. That's the thing. It was kind of noticeable at Davos, for example, this year. Lots of companies that have not been involved in the African continent now want to come and talk about becoming involved in the African continent, that sort of thing. So it's a sort of mutual exercise, but as I said before, we are looking at a number of countries in the Gulf. In fact, I think many of them in the Gulf we're looking at. They've been making big investments, of course, traditionally in the U.S. and the EU. They have vast surplus funds to invest, and now they're not getting the return on them. They're looking for alternatives. As I said, some of the other countries in ASEAN are also seeking us out. There's a new Indonesian trade minister. We have developed a very good rapport with him, and I think we want to build on that in the course of this year. But there's also other countries as well in the ASEAN region that we're obviously looking to consolidate and build with the BRICS, but also as part of our overall diversification with some of these other opportunities. The infrastructure program, of course, the infrastructure program, I think, is intended to deliver many more serious black contractors. I mean, a lot of that is not under the DGI. But then you remember when the president went and met with the BBC, Black Business Council, he said, where are the black manufacturers? That's our business. Where are the black manufacturers? So we want to create opportunities for manufacturing of that and then build on that black manufacturers. And as I said before, you know, this is the whole basis of our the new bill, is to try to make sure that when people are empowered, they're not passive shareholders. Now, if you go into a company, a big company that is trying to empower itself, the black people who are involved there must actually become the engineers, the whatever it is that the business does, and not just the sort of background PR. They must become the real players. And if the small players are involved, they must become seriously empowered to get involved. That's the whole aim of the sort of jigging of the BEE that we're doing. And by the way, just to answer the other question, there will be criminal penalties for fronting. There already are criminal penalties for fraud, but that will be provided for in the bill. The bill will of course come before you, and of course it'll be the subject, I'm sure, of extensive public hearings and so on and so forth. And then of course, one of the things, you talk about rural development, but I think that one of the things that we didn't really say about the SEZ bill, I missed this point, is that it's a tool of industrial decentralization. That's what it is as well. So it can be that we can use it, and these are what the provincial focuses and projects are about. It's about promoting industrial development outside of the established three parts of the country, which are already the hubs of industrial development. Then on the Honourable Abrazini's point, I actually don't quite know what he's referring to, because it hasn't come to us. Now, I think he may be saying that they're accusing us. He used the term best treatment or something, and I don't know whether he means a more favoured nation, that we give certain things to the EU which are better than the United States, and that they're complaining about that. That was not provided for in the AGOA. A goal was a non-reciprocal set of preferences which was agreed by the U.S. Congress. There was no reciprocity that was required of us in the AGOA. And I think that it's not required of us, and we would, as I say, want to maintain the idea that we should continue to roll over the AGOA. I think anything else that's going to replace it is going to be difficult, damaging, and potentially something that will not benefit either ourselves or the United States. On biotechnology, let me just say, we launched a little while ago, biotechnology embraces pharmaceutical products, and pharmaceutical products, we had this indication of the advance in the investment by Lonza in the production of active pharmaceutical ingredients in South Africa, and I think was also more to the point as well, was the link with Pelchem, where the chemicals that are used to produce the active pharmaceutical ingredients will also be produced and accessed in South Africa. On nanotechnology, there is research work which has been done in the DST, and I think you need to follow up on some of that. But, of course, we don't have nanotechnology projects from South Africa which are at the stage of commercialization at this point in time, and that's actually where the DTI comes in. On the question of fraud and so on that's going on our borders, and maybe in the form of exports, fraudulent exports or fraudulent imports. We are stepping up our work of all our agencies. We're also having a serious engagement now with a cluster of justice crime prevention, because I think we've been arguing, and I think they're now taking the point, that we have organized crime, which is cutting across. Very often the same people are involved in import of illegally imports, imports of substandard goods, probably also involved in piracy, DVD piracy, drug smuggling, abalone smuggling, the smuggling of metals, I mean, because illegal mining products go out, the scrap metal and stuff like that. We're trying to work on a comprehensive strategy, and I've been arguing the whole time that on this one, it doesn't matter what we catch them on. We don't have to catch them on the most serious offense. We need to learn from the lessons of Al Capone. I don't know if you all know Al Capone. Al Capone was this gangster in Chicago in the 1930s. Al Capone did a lot of very naughty things. He murdered lots of people. But he ended up going to jail for tax evasion. So whatever we catch them on, doesn't matter. We must catch them. That's the important point. And then we can add the other things later on. So that's the sort of way we're trying to work, more smart. I mean, look, it's an uphill battle. It's not easy stuff. There's a very, the Minister of State Security last year in the budget speech, he mentioned that there's a sizable part of our economy which is characterized by this illicit economy. It also then comes into people who are falsifying company registrations, taking directors off and on. I mean, there's a massive challenge that we face. But in our little corner, we're trying to work much more intelligently. And then we recognize these multiple offenders, catch them on anything, and you know, stop them operating. That's our approach on that. On Iran, let me say, we buy oil from them, we sell them almost nothing. So from our side, it's not really a major issue. The oil issue is being looked at. That's all I can say at this point. The question of efficiencies of ports and so on, that actually falls under public enterprises and maybe the PICC. But I mean, all I'm saying is, so we don't have the data on that particularly. What we do know is what I said already, that all the discounts and everything on port charges are for primary products. The manufactured value-added products therefore suffer a disadvantage, and that our overall port charges are relatively high. We know that, so we're trying to address that. But the responsibility for that is public enterprises and Portnet. Something I've been grappling with as well. How do we measure performance in something like this? And I've actually gone around the world a bit. And I went to this agency ITC in Geneva. International Trade Commission in Geneva, and talked to them. I said, well, what is best practice? And they told me, this is one thing that stuck in my head. They say this trade promotion, investment promotion is an art, not a science. Now, that makes, you know, measurement, I don't think it means no measurement, but it makes measurement fairly difficult. What I can say is that very often people don't understand what it takes to get a foreign investment in this country. The motor industry, those motor industry investments, they don't happen because somebody sits in Germany or Japan and says, good idea to invest in South Africa. There's the local company here, the manager here, is competing against the manager in the same company in some other country of the world. And they are trying to fight for this investment. They come to us, there's a lot of negotiation about, you know, what's the APDP allowance, what's the automotive investment scheme allowance going to look like? As you know, we have two levels. We have the basic level, and then we have the enhanced level. And for the enhanced level, you're going to have to make more guarantees about job creation, localization, stuff like that. So we negotiate with them around that. Then we get a package in place. We then promote it. TISA's involved in all of this. Very often, it's municipalities are involved in this as well. They don't happen by accident. And many of the major investments don't happen by accident. Very, very rare that somebody just walks in and says, I want to set up a factory and I'm not bothering with going to government. Usually they come to government, and usually TISA plays a role in all of that. Then on the question of the budget, I actually what I said was, I don't want to go much further than this, because we are going to come with a strat plan and a budget discussion. But you can see that we've had an increase in the budget. We've had an increase in particularly for the, it's called economic competitiveness, the manufacturing competitiveness support program. And then we've had an increase in particular for the SEZ. Those have been the big new big-ticket items that we've had. Like everybody else, we're having to take a haircut, which means we're going to have to save on many of the other programs. I probably need a haircut more than you do, but the thing is that we will be doing that. But I think we should go into that in more detail. On the question of the National Consumer Commission, I think that we should also just, be wary about, they came and they said that. Of course they would like to have more money. We would like to have more money for industrial policy. We would like to have more money for trade promotion. We'd like to have more money for IT. We'd like to have more money for everything, but there's a budget process that goes on here. So when you interrogate the budget, I think you should interrogate it across the board, and not just in relation to one particular agency. So we found them some more money. They will account for how they spent the money. You will have to interrogate that. What are their existing programs and so on and so forth. But I mean, I think we have a budgeting process in this country, and we go through that budgeting process. We'll present it to you, and Parliament, of course, has a number of powers in relation to the budget process as well.
Just to add to the question about the infrastructure program and the opportunity for black contractors, what we have, when we were working on the designations for sectors, we managed to establish a SOE, state-owned enterprises, which is Transnet and Eskom, a procurement forum, where we're now working jointly to identify all the opportunities in that's coming up, for example, in locomotives and so on. And there we're building in both small business development, we're building in black economic empowerment into that program. And we hope to shortly institutionalize that state SOE procurement forum so that we can really ensure that there is proper leveraging of these investments.
Right. We must thank you for this part of the program, the input here, Mr. Davies, and also the DG, Mr. October, COO, Ms. Schultz, and everyone else. I see their people here from TEO, the COO, Mr. Mangol, Mangola, I just can't quite read it here. Mr. Mandler, Chief Director there, just the DTI there, just got it generally. And sort of the no-name brand one of the company is DTI and manager of the ministry. I'm not sure who's going for the no-name brand. And then the Cameron, the group CEO, Mr. Cameron. I like to read very clear writing. I can read the ministers, of course, and the DGs. I can't even read my own. But be helpful if you could write so I can read it. Mr. Roberts, D, I assumed that was director. And Mr. Ibrahim, Chief of Staff. Nali, Noel. Who's Nali or Noel from something looking like power and pointers? Now, I think some of this writing is totally illegible, perhaps a little coarse than that. And then Adonis Dudley, Telcom, etc. Yeah. Now, thank you to all of you. I always appreciate the DTI when they bring a full team, Minister. So that you've got, it's not a question of saying you have to come back to us every 5 minutes and so on. Thank you very much for that. Now, we're going to have, during this time, we're going to do the changeover. Where is it? an NLB, a couple of key folk here, alongside the DG, I must assume, here, and of course the minister. And I know the minister will ensure he has got the right team just up here. If we can do that now in the next 5-7 minutes, which is tea break. So I suggest you grab your tea, talk as you walk back. Because we are going to start again, for those who are not sure, it is now 11. We are starting sharp at 10 past. You will notice, members, that we didn't do the minutes. I had hoped to apply my mind to these minutes, but we don't yet have that transcript. So I've checked with Mr. Hermans, and he informs me that this will definitely be done by Monday this week. I think there's been a lot of transcripts, and Hansard have been under a lot of pressure, as I'm sure you are aware. But be that as it may, to inform members that I myself, I'm sure many of you are aware, chair the international, parliamentary union engagements, and in particular the IPM-SAEU, and co-chair that with Mr. Cashman from the European Union. Now, the specific preparation which I will be chairing for that will occur on Tuesday. The actual engagement with them, the full dialogue, begins at 8 o'clock on Wednesday and continues for 2 full days. Normally, we ask members of the committee to join us at key moments, but most unfortunately, you are extremely engaged, but all parties, senior parties, are represented, you know, in that IPU, the SAEU. So I shall not be here on Wednesday, all right? So I am asking for nominations for the chairperson to chair that meeting on Wednesday, please.
I propose Whip Hadebe to chair.
Have any a seconder? Just on record, please.
I wish to put it on record that I'm seconding.
Are there any objections? No. Fine. So then I think the matter is decided, and of course an appeal to all of us to be, well, not to myself as such, but to other members of the committee to ensure, as Honourable James and McIntosh have reminded us, to be here on time. According to the rules of Parliament, another chair may be chosen within 15 minutes of the meeting opening officially. Thank you. Right. Now, that was, of course, the urgent business we needed to take care of with the full quorum. But we would now like to thank and welcome the chairperson of the National Lotteries Board and his delegation, the chairperson, Professor Nietzscheng-Zeni. I'm used to saying Professor Nebutanda, and then that, of course, is a lot easier for me. You're very welcome. Your Chief Operating Officer, Mr. Jeffrey Dupree, right, and your Communications Manager, Mr. Sirshan Naidu, right. I am going to make an effort over the Easter period to learn the pronunciation of the coarser names and certain other names. Thank you. My apologies. Well, Minister, you are once again welcome, and the DG.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to make a few introductory points. The main presentation will be given by the Chair of the Lotteries Board. I thought that it was important, and thank you for accommodating this request that we made, that we have an opportunity for a strategic engagement around the questions of the lotteries and the lotteries fund. I think we've seen a lot of fairly ad hoc discussion about the lotteries in recent times, and I think we felt it was necessary to contextualize quite a bit of that. I want to make it clear that the role of the minister and the department is one which is defined by the Lotteries Act, which I think the presentation will outline, and there is a mechanism in place whereby decisions about any particular allocation are in the hands of people other than the political office bearers, which I think is a correct appropriate way of operating. I think it would be the very worst thing if the minister was able to sit around or the minister was lobbied about one application or another. So I think that's the background to this. I also wanted to just say that the lotteries issue fell on my plate when I became the minister. And at that time, in the beginning of 2009, there were a ton of complaints about the fact that there were huge amounts of lotteries funds which were sitting unspent and unallocated in the lottery National Lotteries Distribution Trust Fund. And what happened was I had a number of interactions with the then board, with the department, with the distribution agencies at the time. And we embarked on a process of incremental reforms. We started off by trying to identify some of the administrative matters which were in place, which were creating that situation of large sums of money sitting undistributed. We then saw that there were regulatory matters we needed to address. And we also saw that there was a need at the same time to amend the Lotteries Act, which is an act which has come into place, which came into place shortly after our democratic transition, and has got many features in it which I think we recognize need modernizing. One of the things that happened subsequent to that, of course, was that the new Lotteries Board was appointed under the chairperson. And in terms of the Act, this was something which happened here in the Portfolio Committee, that you sat down and held the hearings and you were the ones who made the recommendations. That's how the Act is structured. I want to say that there is a picture which I want to just underscore. And it's in terms of the distribution of lotteries funds. When I came in, as I said, this was the complaint. Now, there's a graph, but I want to give the figures because I think the figures tell us a story. In 2008, the total cash which was dispersed by the lotteries was 635 million rand. Now, that was a little bit unusual because in 2008 there was a question around the operating license and there was no lotto for several months. But if you take the year before, the figure was 789 million rand. And what happened in the subsequent years, in 2009, the figure went up to 949 million. In 2010, 1.9 billion. And in 2011, we distributed 3.55 billion rand. So I think that we have substantially increased the dispersal of funding over the last 3 years. Take, for example, one of them, charities. In 2008, 327 million rand was distributed to charities. In 2007, it was 409 million. In 2009, it went up to 481 million. It was 1.1 billion in 2010 and 1.8 billion in 2011. So I think that what we have done is we have unblocked some of the blockages around the distribution. We did this in, I think, essentially by scrapping what was in place before. There was the board had an oversight committee which it second-guessed every single transaction that went out, and it took ages and ages and ages. We smoothed that procedure. That was one of the reforms we introduced. Secondly, there were a number of serious anomalies around that meant that the people who would apply were limited. You had to have 2 years audited financial statements in order to qualify, as well as be a registered charity, for example, which meant that established charities were able to access it, but that other community-based projects were not able to. And I remember when I was the chair of a committee, I intervened on behalf of one once. And it didn't make any jot of difference. That was the rule. Those people, it was a project of somebody who was working out here in Mfuleni, working with AIDS orphans, was supported by many churches, given all kinds of awards, couldn't get any lottery funding because she didn't have 2 years for audited financial statements. So we don't demand that any longer in the Companies Act. So we're trying to change some of those rules and regulations. Then the Lotteries Board has gone out and it's done a campaign, because I think we've said that far too many of the old established charities were getting the money, community projects were not getting the money. So we've tried to broaden the pool of access. And though they've gone out and they've made this thing known, their calls are much more widely publicized and so on. And I think that a number of the funds that have gone out, and you'll see later on the presentation, have gone to new players in this area. Now, I think that creates its own kinds of problems and confusions, because if there's I should perhaps say that in the last little while, because of the state of the economy, we have not seen a substantial increase in lotteries revenue. People are not playing the lottery on an expanding, ever-expanding scale. And I think that, you know, can we say they're wrong? This is a form of gambling which your odds of winning are 14.5 million to 1. Many low-income people play this. But the only justification of allowing that game is if we actually distribute to the good causes. So we've actually tried to make sure we distribute to the good causes and we broaden the appeal. Now, I think there can be many, many issues around the governance and the reform of the lottery system in South Africa that we can debate and discuss. But I think that what would be very important is if we view this strategically, because I think what we've had is we've had a mixing up of things, that we've had very often some individual case in point has come along and said, I didn't get the funding I received before. Now, there may be tons of reasons why they haven't received that funding. They can include the fact that they haven't actually delivered very much in terms of their mandate. It can include the fact that they have done no other fundraising. It can include all sorts of reasons why they haven't got it. But I think we should separate that out from the effectiveness of the lottery system. I don't think that the reform process that we've instituted is by any means complete yet, but it's ongoing work. I think that if there are any instances of corruption or fraud that are going on in the lottery system that we become aware of, we would want to know about that, and we would want to follow that through without fear or favor. We are not tolerating any corruption in the lottery system. I'm sure that there are administrative improvements which could be made, which I'm sure that honorable members may even have some useful suggestions around. But I think that the point I want to make is I think that this is ongoing work in progress, and that is the is where we find ourselves. Before I hand over to the chair to give a presentation, which is something which we also wanted to be present at, because we want to see the way in which the issues are presented and how members interact with those, I want to say one other thing, that the early retirement of the CEO, I think, was misunderstood to be something to do with the question of the distribution of the lotteries. It had nothing whatsoever to do with any of the distribution of lotteries funds. In fact, next year, we will be going into the process of appointing a new operator of the lotteries. The contract of the current consortium is going to expire, and there will be a new process of awarding an operator license in whatever form that may take. That's something which we are considering. And that is a process where there's already a lot of interest. You remember last time around that there were numerous court cases that followed, and that it meant that the lotteries didn't operate for a period of time because the term of the old one had expired and so on. We're trying to prepare for that in a way which is absolutely clean and transparent, because we know that there's a good likelihood that people who don't win this thing are going to go to court. And we want to make sure that the opportunities are minimized and that we don't do anything wrong in terms of procedure. And in that regard, the CEO indicated to us that he was interested in advising one of the applicants for the new lottery's operator license. And we said, not compatible with being the CEO. He agreed to that, and he took early retirement. That was what the story was. So it had nothing to do with distribution and anything to do with the operator license. So I thought it was necessary to clarify that. With those remarks, Chair, I'd now be happy to hand over to the Chair of the Lotteries Board.
Thank you. Professor Nebutanda.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, Honorable Minister, for the introduction. We are here as we believe that we account to the Portfolio Committee of Trade and Industry, and we are accountable to the Parliament of the Republic of South Africa. We are going to look at a number of issues which the Minister did summarize as part of, we've put them as part of our agenda, which we want to clarify some of the issues that have been running around. First of all, there have been an alarming voices to say the National Lotteries Board does not know its mandate. We are here to indicate to honorable members that we do understand our mandate, we do understand the challenges that we are facing. One of the things that we need to clarify is that our mandate is found in the Lotteries Act, which the committee is aware of. And if I can just indicate some few issues that shows our mandate is, we advise the minister from time to time on the issuance of the license. And as he has already indicated, our interaction with the minister have already started because we don't want to fail the department and the minister and the Parliament of the Republic. We also advise the minister on the percentages allocated to good causes. So that also try to answer that it is not just a willy-nilly to say today we are going to allocate sport this amount of percentage, today we are going to allocate this percentage to charities. It is something that has to be found in the Act and the regulations. We also advise the minister on the efficiency of legislation related to lotteries. For example, if you read our annual reports, from time to time, every year we indicate things that must be included in the coming legislation so that at least the legislation will talk to what the public wants outside. We also advise the minister on the protection of players, maximizing proceeds to good causes, administer the National Lottery Distribution Trust Fund. That is the trust which is which has been registered and it is administered by the National Lotteries Board. We monitor and regulate other lotteries. Then the appointment, the minister hinted about the appointment of the board. It was a public nomination. No political party was involved to send names of candidates. I think the portfolio committee knows that it was a lot of people who had interest, and they shortlisted. We were called here to come and answer questions, and those questions we answered them after having been vetted by the NIA, so that you don't just appoint people who are crooks, people who have got criminal records and whatever. So that is how the board was appointed. This slide is about the National Lottery Distribution Trust Fund. The Act establishes the NLDTF as a fund. This fund receives money from the lottery operator. And this money is put in a trust. The trustees are members of the board. In this case, you're aware that we are seven in numbers. That is six directly appointed and one member from the, one member that is who represents the minister from Department of Trade and Industry. The function of this trust is as follows. We collect revenue, and this revenue consists of a percentage of sales of lottery products. In other words, these sales are sales that ourselves, the minister, have agreed with the lottery operator to say, this is how much you are going to put back to the NLDTF. In this case, the current lottery operator agreed in the license to give us 34% of the total sale, you know, the total sales that operator shall have made. Well, the previous one didn't. The previous one was on a progression stage. In other words, starting from 17%, and when they exited, they were around 26-27%. But this one agreed on just a flat level, say, always for the duration of our license, we'll be giving NLB 34% to put it in the NLDTF. We also make sure that we get interest because of the investment that we make. Because that money, when the money comes, the money for 2011 comes to the trust without being used by the trust, so that we use it during 2012-2013. We also collect other monies lawfully paid into the fund. For example, if the operator breaches some of the license prescriptions, we do institute the penalties. The monies that people play, those that buy lotto tickets and not claim, after a year, those monies went back to the trust. Fund shall be audited by the Auditor General. In other words, the funds that we collect are audited by the Auditor General. The usage of that fund is also audited by the Auditor General. As members will be aware that from time to time we send the annual reports to Parliament, so that you can see how we have dispersed those funds, how we have paid the employees of the NLD. The categories of the NLDTF, that is National Lottery Distribution Trust Fund. In terms of the Act, there are sectors or categories. The first one is Reconstruction and Development Program, which didn't even receive any funding. In other words, we didn't use it, but it's still there in the Act until the Act is amended. It will reflect 0%. Charities receive 45% of the total amount. If this coming financial year, if we are going to budget for 1.5 billion, charities will get 45% of that 1.5 billion. Sport, arts, and sports and recreation, 22%. Arts, culture, national heritage, 28%. Miscellaneous, 5%. These funds are distributed by distributing agencies. Now, the question arises, the miscellaneous purpose fund, who distributes it? The board, in terms of the Act, at its meeting, they are appointed to distribute the 5% as distributing agency miscellaneous, no longer as NLB. So that is how the Act gives us. We have got two roles, that is to manage the trust, and also at times where there are projects that need to be adjudicated, we adjudicate them in the form of miscellaneous distributing agency. As I said, the RDP is not active. The appointment of distributing agencies. Now, I've indicated how the board is appointed. The board does not distribute 100% of the NLDTF. They only distribute 5%. 95% of the NLDTF is distributed by the distributing agencies. These distributing agencies, the manner in which they are appointed by the public, the civil society in general. A call for nomination is advertised in all the newspapers, and the public nominate distributing agency members, looking at their skills, their competencies, to go and serve in the distributing agencies. So the board does not have any hand, the minister, the department does not have any hand. It is the public that nominate those people who sit in the distributing agencies. The manner in which they are appointed, for example, the charities are appointed by the minister in consultation with the Minister of Social Development. The Sports and Recreation Distributing Agency is appointed by the minister in consultation with the Minister of Sport and Recreation. So is the Arts and Culture. They are also appointed in consultation with the Minister of Arts and Culture. In this case, two agencies, that is the charities and the arts, have been appointed last year on the 1st of September. They are now in the NLB distributing the funds. The NLDTF revenue and disbursement. If you look at this schedule, you will understand that from ever since the lottery came into being, we have collected 12 billion. Interest on this 12 billion is 3 billion, 3.6 billion. Total revenue up to date is 15.9 billion. This is the money that lottery operator took back to the NLDTF for disbursement, for investment, and whatever. Cash disbursed since inception is more than 10.9 billion. This is the money that we have already disbursed from the year 2000 until now. Spent on administration at a percentage of 2.4% is 336 million. Funds on hand, 4.8 billion. Less amount already committed as at 31st March 2011 is 3.1 billion. Cash available for allocations in 2011-2012 until end of March is 1.7 billion. Jeff?
Thank you, Chairperson. Minister and members of the committee. This particular slide, I think it connects with what the minister was talking about regarding the, especially from 2008-09 financial year, the substantial increase in disbursements. And just to clarify, there's three bars here. The one is obviously the blue one speaks directly in terms of the transfer of the 34% that the chairperson referred to in terms of the license agreement. Then the allocations. In other words, the allocations is where the distributing agencies as a collective now, I'm saying across the four, including the board as the miscellaneous, they then decide and say we have agreed to allocate 300,000 rand to FAMSA Western Cape. Now, I think sometimes what is confusing in the public and some of our stakeholders, they don't appreciate the difference between that and the cash disbursed. And sometimes they compare it like apples with pears. Because what happened, Madam Chair, in that allocation for a particular year, you have once-off allocations, 100,000 rand to an old age home, once-off, but you also have bigger grants, which we will show some of them later on, where you actually either or a combination of multi-year, like SASCOC, funds that we'll be reflecting on, has actually been multi-year funding. But you can also have multi-tranche funding within a specific year. In other words, I'm saying I'm willing to give you 1.2 million, but I'm not going to give 1.2 million on signing of the contract of the grant agreement. I'm giving you in three tranches, equal, or it can be progressive in terms of an aligned to your project plan. Now, then the cash disbursed is the one that the minister focused on. In other words, that again must be understood that it reflects on the disbursement in a particular financial year. Again, it is a combination of projects that was approved in a particular year, but also it relates to projects previously approved, which tranche number 2 or 3 is now paid within a particular financial year. And I thought it's just important to clarify that because when we explain now to the beneficiaries and say that, technically speaking, if you look, we disbursed 3.5 billion in a particular financial year, but for the current financial year, we only got 1.7 billion. And then they ask, what happened with the rest of the money? Right. So, in part of this, Chair, and it's very difficult to say it yourself, but I think we need to say this, and I think the Minister alluded to that. Part of that picture is actually you becoming a victim of success. Because the 3.5 billion was not a collection of a particular financial year's finances. That 3.5 billion consisted of, say, 1.something billion of that particular year, plus the surpluses that has been built over time due to some of the inefficiencies. So as the Minister explained, you gear up, you institute certain mechanisms, you are actually working away the surpluses. So basically what we are working currently on, more or less, Madam Chair, is a particular financial year's income. In other words, as the Chair said, that 1.7 billion was collected last year, and we're spending it in this financial year. We're currently sitting with the cash on hand, unaudited, Chair, 1.9 billion. Out of that 1.9 billion, 500 million relates to the current year's financial year. So for the period up till end of January, we have then now collected already 1.4 billion that will now be used in our 2012-13 financial year. Obviously, there's still 2 months that we can gear up in terms of the additional income that we're going to receive. So that is just Chair, just a little bit on that particular graph. And I think the next one is trying to explain that more, but to say, Chair, there's a lot of independencies and there's a lot of unpredicted things in terms of, because we can't predict the cash, the sales of the lot. As the Minister alluded, economic things, people's perception sometimes, they slow down. And I think sometimes you also get very general reporting that says, people say because of reported problems, people say they're going to stop playing. We haven't seen that reflected in the sales check, which actually, if you look at the previous slide, for 2009, 2010, and 2011, you can actually see from the blue bars, quite almost static. In other words, your annual income at the moment for that last 3 years was actually kind of very static in terms of if you allow for a little bit variance here and there. Chair, I think the last point that was made very explicitly by the chairperson is just to say that at any particular time, the balance reflected in our books is a combination of available funds for further distribution, but also a big portion has to do with funds already committed. Now, Chair, just to put the 1.7 billion in context, our applications that we've received, as the Minister said, we've gone on roadshows, we've done awareness, we have actually have seen a very big increase in 2011 in terms of number of applications. Now, roughly, we have estimated if you were to give everybody what they asked for, you would have to have 40 billion rand. We only had 1.7 billion. So, Chair, the point that I want to make here is that even if everybody of 12,500 applicants qualify, it is not feasible and it is not possible that you're going to give everybody, unless you decide to give everybody 100 rand and get a project that doesn't make any sense, just for the sake of saying that you have spread the cake. And the other point that was recently very much in the media, Chair, is a reduction in what people perceived almost like the entitled annual amount. In other words, we've received a lot of reports where people say, I used to get 4 million over the last 4 years, and now with the last decision, it was reduced to 1 million. And Chair, if you go to the regulations of July 2010, you will see there is a big obligation, an institutionalized obligation, on the distributing agencies as representatives, in this case of implementation arm of government, to make sure that part of the considerations is to make sure that the funds are equitably distributed. And that's one of those things that sometimes it's between people, they don't want to regard it as science, but if you just take the logic of 1.7 billion versus the 3.5 billion, add to that an increase of applicants, it is just logic, Chair, that you have to cut back in terms of your average size of grants, but furthermore, Chair, that some people that used to get might not be getting, because there's people that have been getting for 5, 6, 7 years, there is people that's not reported on that has been applying for 5 years and never got a cent from the lottery. So when you give some of those people now 100,000 rand, then they say now you're discriminating as such. So, Chair, the key things about some of those stats is the lottery sales still remains the major source of our income. And as you can get from that graph, there has been a growth. We are sitting now currently in terms of sales about around 4.7 billion for 2011. The minister alluded to the dip in 2008. I think partly it was the effect of that court cases around the location, the awarding of the new license. And, but what is interesting and is very encouraging, Chair, is that the fund in terms of the sales is starting to get back to what it was before that particular break. Because what you must remember is that there you have substitute products. So when you don't have a lottery running for 6 months, some of the guys will migrate to something else. And it's not all of them that will come back by the time that you reintroduce actually the game. So that is basically part of the reasons that that contributed to that. Chair, later on, I think in the short-term interventions, there's been also a lot of issues about, Chair, about lifestyle orders and so forth. But the fact of the matter is 2.4% currently, Chair, on average, has been spent on administration as a percentage of the total. And I think many around this room, Chair, would know that for fund disbursement, internationally you talk about 10 to 15%. However, one must hasten to say maybe we've been too conservative, and hence later on I think the Chair will talk to some of the measures taken to increase capacity. We, Chair, we still remain, and I think we are still the largest funder of your non-profit sector at the moment and of your community-based organizations in this regard. Chair, this is the point just to reinforce that particular point, and that is what the Minister referred to in terms of that increase. And I think the point I've already explained, Chair, that that if you take that income sales that's been static and that you have now got less money available and you've increased your disbursement, Chair, somehow that must reflect some level of efficiency gains as such.
This some of the projects from charities that we have funded. I think members, when they have time, they can just look at the pictures there. We don't only fund organizations that are residing in the urban areas. We also go to the rural areas so that we can make the difference there. If you check on charities, major grants that we've made, this is just but an indication. For example, NSRI, over the years, the total amount that we have given them is more than 17.1 million. The micro, without, babies that affiliate to micro, up to so far, at national level, we have given them more than 120 million. Cancer, 95 million at national. St. John's Ambulance Service, 28.7 million. FAMSA, Westerns, 3.3 million. Oh, I should have indicated that the figure that you see there is a total of national and even provincial. But then we wanted to make an addendum on each organization. We have given you the an additional paper. Charities projects in rural disadvantaged areas. We talk of Sunshine Child Development Center in Sanin, Riga Park Early Childhood and Women's Development in Gauteng, Methodist Homes for the Aged in Free State, Prisca Utilities in Northern Cape. When it comes to arts and culture, because we fund music, arts, national heritage, part of tourism, the greening of towns, the greening of places. These are some of the examples that we, of organizations that we've funded. The arts and culture, if you check in terms of organizations, Johannesburg JPO, which is Johannesburg Philharmonic Orchestra, up to ever since the inception, with every year assisting them, we have already given them more than 46.1 million. CPO Western Cape, more than 30.6 million. National Arts Festival, more than 42.9 million. SA Sun Institute, 7.6 million. Greater Rustenburg Community Foundation, more than 7.9 million. Association for Persons with Disabilities and the Deaf, 2.5 million. South African Wildlife College, more than 9.5 million. When it comes to sports, these are some of the projects that we fund, which appear there. In terms of major grants that we've made, you look at SASCOC, we, up to date, we have given them 344 million. Swimming South Africa, 75 million. Tennis, 45.6 million. 2010, Local Organizing Committee Legacy Project, 170 million. Some of these legacy projects are listed here. In all the provinces, there are 27 in number. In other words, it was a project of building artificial turf stadia, mini stadia that kids can go and play. This is the Holy Family School Mkhwase project, artificial turf. Before it was, before we funded LOC, this was the type of the ground. After we funded them, this is how the ground looks like. So we did it in all provinces. You can check Pavalo, Uppington, how it was before and how it is now. Jenfeth, Limpopo, how it was before and how it is now. Kedidra School, Everton in Gauteng, the ground, how it was before and how it is now. Let me get into challenges. There were concerns raised in 2009. These concerns, we, as the NLB, we took note of those concerns. For example, funds were not optimally disbursed. As the minister indicated, that there were a number of meetings, the forum between the members from the NLB, distributing agencies, and the Department of Trade and Industry. Arts and culture had decreased by 56.8%. That is 190.7 million. It was a cause for concern because money was there in the trust, but the one that was distributed was very, very small. Charities had decreased by 35%. That is 631.7 million to 409.4 million. These are the concerns that in 2009, the department, the NLB, and distributing agencies sit down and try to look at those things so that they can unblock those issues. And after this concern, the minister himself, together with the DDG in the department, met with the affected parties in order to show them this is how we could unblock all these conditions that are that are not making the distributing agency to distribute the fund. And some of these issues, as the minister indicated, resides in the regulations, the amendment of the act, issues of conflict of interest, issues of quorum. When the distributing agency meets, sometimes we invite them, they will come and they don't form a quorum, so they cannot proceed with the adjudication. The SC indicated there was an oversight committee that was to look at each and every application that has been processed by the distributing agency. So that means you are now prolonging the turnaround time. And as such, some of the challenges that the NLD faced, apart from the 2009, are as follows. Application-based model is a problem, and it needs to be combined with either focused-based model, wherein distributing agencies can look at areas where there is need, and they go and make sure that they fund such places. Expectation of recurrent and permanent refunding. In other words, there are organizations, as the COO indicated. Once they have received funding for the past 2 years, they believe they develop what we call entitlement. In other words, if you decline their funding or if you reduce what they are requesting, so they feel, no, it is not good. You should have given us money. Of course, one of the things that we are starting to check is that some of these organizations, going forward, we need to make sure that we conduct a lot of workshops so that we don't raise too much expectation on them, so that they can also go out and do some fundraising. Because I think National Lottery can't be the only fund for these organizations. Exploitative practice of professional fundraisers. You know, poor organizations in the rural areas become prey to fundraisers who go there and say, we know how to draft proposals. We know you can get 5 million, you can get 20 million. And what they do is that they charge 10% in whatever they raise. And NLDTF has to fund that 10%. So these are some of the challenges that we are facing. And when you try to cut that 10%, the organization says, no, but this is the agreement that I've already agreed with the fundraiser. Therefore, you have to pay me, or else I will use the money that you are giving me to pay the 10%. Some of the organizations recently, when they submit applications, we find that the management fee is 25%. So you calculate 25% of an organization that has received 20 million. It's just 5 million which that person has to be paid in the first tranche. So these are some of the challenges that we are facing. Now, what are the interventions? As I said, in 2009, there were a lot of things that were put forward. Immediately, the oversight committee was done away with, in other words, because it was prolonging the turnaround time. The minister, after consultation, issued regulations to streamline the application process. In other words, the application process became much simpler than ever before. The minister, again, issued a directive on how funds should be distributed, because that is the power that resides in with the minister. In other words, if you check the 2011 calls for charities and arts, it was under the directive to say at least 50% should go to rural areas. In other words, even if organizations from urban areas apply in large numbers, we are compelled to make sure that of that cake, 50% should go and address the rural challenges. The regulations also relaxed the requirements. For example, if an organization if the organization is in our database and it has applied before, we don't need a lot of documents like, you know, two sets of financial statements. One is enough. The regulations, again, also make sure that it is not only registered accountants that must be considered when you look at an application. You must also look at the bookkeepers, because the problem with the funding model that we have here in South Africa is that all applications, whether they are big, whether it is only 50,000, the way in which you treat them equally. And, you know, on our, when we travel and check and compare with other models, we found that how can you demand two audited financial statements from an organization that wants only 20,000 or 50,000, equally with the one that needs 30 million, 40 million and the like. So the regulations made it easier for us to can operate with ease. We also conducted outreach programs. For example, we went to all provinces on a roadshow, and I think organizations came in large numbers. We were telling them how to apply, how to understand the application form, how to write a proposal, and which are the sectors that you can direct your proposals to. And that, I think, worked very well, because before the roadshow, charities used to get applications amounting to only 4,000. After the roadshow last year, we got, from charities alone, we got 8,000. Sport and recreation used to get less than 2,000. After the roadshow, we got more than 3,000. Arts and culture used to get sometimes even less than 1,000. After the roadshow, we get more than 1,600 applications. That shows that people begin to understand what to do and how to do it. Of course, there will be some spoiled papers in the manner in which they present their applications. Legislative changes. We believe that amongst the real actions that the minister and the department helped us to do, we also feel that legislation needs to be changed so that at least there is clear responsibilities of the minister, the board, and the agencies. In other words, that is how the three parties should operate, so that at least we don't just leave the board doing its own work, leaving the agencies doing its own work, so that at least there is a coordination. Improving efficiency in distribution of the funds, we believe that the model has to be interrogated so that at least it becomes a combination of focused, and also we can allow people to apply as and when they need to apply. Also making sure that through our online systems, we can allow organizations that can put their applications using the online. Accountability of distributing agencies. As it is, we believe that distributing agencies are not accounting on their activities. As I said, they distribute 95% of the cake. We distribute 5% of the cake, and we are the ones who must go and account on some of the irregularities that happened in the adjudication of the distributing agents. So we believe that if there is something that can be done, we know that currently we, together with the minister, we developed the procedure manual that minimizes the tension between the board and the distributing agencies, between the distributing agencies and the administration. At least one can say with confidence that there is that, you know, that spirit of working together, advising each other, and making sure that we deliver the goods as expected. Well, of course, another one is the size of the board. The board that administers this fund that I'm telling you consists of only 6 members plus 1 member from DTI. And I think this this could be one of the smallest boards in the country. Well, there are some legislative changes that I believe when the minister made an introduction, he also touched them. Now, what are the corrective measures after all this? We as the NLB, together with the distributing agencies, we had several meetings some 2 weeks ago in order to understand what the public is crying about. How can we come to the party? You are all aware that on the 26th, on the 27th of March, there was a march that was staged that came to the National Lottery. They presented a memorandum which had a lot of issues that they were raising. So we came up with short-term operational fixes, which are as mandated by the national endeavor that we had last year in July, which I think attracted more than 1,500 NPOs and CBOs to come and chart the way forward for the NLB, NLDTF. The other fixes are medium-term fixes requiring new regulations, of course. For example, the issue of the application form. We are busy consulting with the distributing agencies so that we can send a revised application form to the minister, which is user-friendly than the one which we have. Which in one of I think it was here in Cape Town, where somebody said, "I'm a professor, but to fill that form, it took me the whole week because I couldn't understand it." And you expect somebody from a rural area to fill that form, which is in the foreign language from our own language. Medium-term fixes requiring amendment of the Act, which we believe it is your terrain. We, as one of increasing our accessibility to the NLDTF, we believe that from now we are sending information to all distributing channels. We are improving our distributing channels, and that includes your tribal authorities, local municipalities, so that at least whenever an organization wants to approach National Lottery, they can go to these places and get documents and get flyers so that it is not only in the national media. Translation of documentation into more official languages. This we have already indicated that, for example, the application form. There is no way that we can go to this financial year or a new call with the form that we have now. We need to improve that form so that at least people can access they can access and understand our document. We have now thought it wise to establish a help desk so that every organization that comes to the National Lottery, they can be helped rather than to submit a document which is not complete. They have to be helped because some of these organizations don't understand how to fill in those forms. Focused workshops before we make a call for application. In other words, we'll again move to all provinces to so that we can clarify. For example, if a call is about only developmental projects, we'll have to say it upfront so that those that want just a festival may not even use their energy to fill in the form to apply. They know that we have been told this is not for their time. This is the time for only looking at developmental projects and so on. Increase the circulation period for calls to at least 2 months. In other words, in the past we used to it used to be a very short time for organizations to can respond to. And as I said earlier on, it is not only calls that we are looking at. We are also looking at opening it up as long as we understand that during this first quarter of the year, only calls relating to these aspects are accommodated, so that we don't have a closing date, an opening date and a closing date for such calls. People must walk in freely to come and put in their calls, as long as we shall have notified the public through media and so on. The turnaround times, well, some of these things that I'm talking about, for example, progress reports, processing of applications, the turnaround time we are implementing as from March this year. Strengthening performance management, we are quite sure that come June this year, everything shall have been in place. For example, the NLB, Honorable Chairperson and Minister, for the past 10 years, it was only operating at a lean structure. The CEO, the COO. We, as the board, the new board, last year we agreed to restructure the whole organization, wherein we are going to have a CEO, senior executive grant funding, executive compliance that will look at our legal issues and whatever, executive corporate services, chief IT specialist or chief IT officer, and chief risk officer. All these positions were not there. Hence, you can understand some of the challenges that we are facing, because it was a very lean structure. And we believe that come the 1st of April, because the top executive positions, I think end of this week or next week, they will be out for public to know so that they can apply. We are trying to attract men and women who can come and steer this ship to a new direction. Review of business process, simplified grant agreement for smaller grants, as I indicated. You find that, as I said, there was no distinction between somebody who wants 5 rand and somebody who wants 100 million. It was just the same grant agreement. So we are trimming down that grant agreement so that it is amount and project specific, so that you don't just give somebody a very big grant agreement who only wants just 100,000. So those are the problems that we are now making sure that we implement them. And we also went on further after consulting with CPI and ourselves to say the grant, the